Hello. So I'll be speaking about building a software appliance from open and closed components today. I'll give you a brief introduction about who I am. I'm a software engineer at a company called Delphix, and we are based in Menlo Park, California. And our product is an agile data management solution. We create these things called virtual databases. And these virtual databases can be snapshotted, cloned, and provisioned on demand from any point in time. So if you think about VMware, how you can create virtual machines and move them from one hypervisor to another, take snapshots of them, and make clones from the snapshots, or go back in time and revert a VM to an old snapshot, we do the same thing, but for databases. And I've worked on a few projects at Delphix since I joined. These have been covering a variety of different topics. I've worked on the ZFS file system and added feature flag support, which is a way of coordinating on-disk format changes between different groups of developers. I've worked on integrating the authentication of our appliance with the operating system authentication. I've worked on the distribution of our operating system. And most recently, I've been working on Postgres virtual databases. So we support a lot of different DBMS systems, and I've been adding support for Postgres recently. So that's a bit of background as far as who I am. So when I took a look at the topics for this conference, this one struck a chord, Flowers for a Walled Garden. And the description was, how should free and open source software deal with closed ecosystems? And as soon as I read this, I thought, wow, this is what we do really well at Delphix. And we should talk about that. Because at Delphix, we have our own operating system, which we work on pretty actively. And it's an open source operating system. We're very involved in the community that's developing it. And on top of that, we have a proprietary agile data management application. And almost all of the engineers that I work with, including myself, we work on both. We work on the open source operating system, and we work on the proprietary data management application at the same time. And during this talk, I'd like to show you how we balance this participation in open and closed communities at Delphix, and how we also give back to the community, and some of the challenges that we face in building such an appliance that has a mixture of different components. So I'm going to be talking about two main topics, and I'll pause after the first topic and give you a chance to ask some questions. The first topic is, how do we design and implement a software system that consists of both open source and closed components? And here I'll talk about a few different things. How we choose licenses appropriately, how we manage a large number of licenses during the build process, how we provide visibility to customers about what kind of licenses we're using, and how we keep the open components separate from the closed components. And then for the second part of the talk, I'll focus on how we give back to the community at Delphix. And this includes not only doing things like contributing code, but also mentoring people in the open source community, providing build infrastructure and QA infrastructure, and how to develop a culture of contributing back to open source within a traditionally closed kind of company. So before I get into the first part, I'll just spend one slide talking about what Delphix does to provide some context for the discussion of our appliance. This is not a talk about Delphix, but it's important to understand what this appliance does as I describe how it's built, because it has some fairly unique constraints. So as I mentioned earlier, at Delphix, we provide something called agile data management. And the result of this is what we call virtual databases. And this is just an abstraction over the data files and the transaction logs from traditional DBMSs. So we're not a new type of database. We are simply an abstraction over traditional databases like Oracle or SQL Server or Postgres, for example. And what we do is maintain what we call a time flow of changes from a production database. So we ship an appliance, and customers boot up the appliance in their network, and they have their traditional production database server. And we suck in all of the changes that are taking place on that production source onto our appliance and our own storage. So we start by taking a backup of their database, and then we keep the backup always synchronized with the changes that they make. And from that point, we allow people to provision what we call virtual databases. And essentially, they can pick any point in time and provision a copy of the database at that point in time. They can also take snapshots and refresh the databases with new data from production or go back in time to old data. And this is very useful for things like testing, QA, reporting, even development, because oftentimes the database has to be in sync with the application. And when you have 10 terabytes of data, it really takes a long time to revert to an older copy of the data. You have to copy very large amounts of data. Copying that much data takes a very long time. Sometimes you need to buy new hard drives, install these hard drives, wait a couple days until someone installs them, wait a couple days until the storage admin sets up a LUN, wait a couple days until the DBA has time to provision a new instance. So this process can take many days, even weeks sometimes, and we make that a lot quicker. So if you think about an analogy that I think developers can understand easily, these virtual databases are kind of like version control for databases. So I'm sure most of you have used Git. And with Git, you can easily make a branch from any commit in the past, and continue to make changes on your branch. Then you can merge changes from other branches into yours. And you can do kind of the same operations with these virtual databases. That's just one use case. There are many others. People use it for backup. People use it for replication. But I think Git for databases is kind of a good analogy. I won't spend much time on this slide, but this is kind of an idea of what our appliance does. So if you think of these blocks as file systems on our appliance, we start with the data source, and that is essentially a copy of the customer's production source database. So we take a full backup, and this takes a lot of time, but there's no way around it. And then as the production database is changing, as people are doing operations, this generates transaction logs. And we copy these transaction logs onto our appliance and keep our appliance always in sync with the production. And then we can take snapshots, which are these double lines in the slide at points in time. And what we let people do is provision a copy from any snapshot, and that's in constant time. So if you wanted to provision a virtual database from over here, that would be a constant time operation. And beyond that, we let you provision virtual databases from any point in time, not just the snapshots. So if I want a copy of the database at a very specific time, you know, within a transaction log, we can actually create a virtual database from that point in time and replay the transactions up until the point that you requested. So we have a very high degree of precision. And as the picture shows, you can not only create virtual databases from a data source, but you can also create them from other virtual databases. So you have this nested ability to branch your database and make changes to it. Was anything confusing about this? Does this kind of provide a good background for, okay. So, part one, how we built this appliance. So this contains our own operating system, our own orchestration layer, because we're doing a lot of things. We're connecting to a production database, pulling transaction logs, creating file systems, snapshotting file systems, mounting them over NFS, starting up DBMS instances on other servers. So we have this orchestration layer. And of course, we have a CLI and a GUI to manage everything. So this is a high-level overview of our software, or rather our appliance. So starting at the bottom, you can see we have what we call our platform, which is the kernel and our basic user land software. And then we have some third-party user land software that is essential to building any kind of system. We have a bunch of libraries that are used by our orchestration application, and as well as the GUI and the CLI, what we call the application libraries. And then we have our application on top. And the licenses, I've kind of summarized them in this slide, but we have a lot of different licenses at play, a lot of CDDL, a lot of BSD and MIT, especially in the platform. In the third-party user land, we have some GPL, some LGPL as well. The application libraries are very varied, and our application itself is proprietary. So combining these things all together can be a little bit challenging sometimes, and that's what I'll discuss. So what are the requirements we had when we built this appliance? The main one was that we had to have a really good file system. I mentioned that we allow people to create copies of their databases, and this really depends on having a copy-on-write file system to make the snapshots and clones in an efficient way. And we chose ZFS. It's a very nice file system that has a lot of features, but most importantly, it lets you take an unlimited number of snapshots, and you can take the snapshots in constant time. And these snapshots don't require any additional copies of the data. So following the copy-on-write principle, you only incur disk usage when you're adding new changes, not when you're changing old things, not when you're looking at old things. And so that was kind of the high-level requirement. But then as far as the licenses go, we wanted to keep the open and closed code in separate repositories. And we also wanted to give customers visibility into the licenses of the software that we're using. Oftentimes people will ask us how things are working under the hood, and we need to be able to be transparent about that. So these are some of the goals we had. So first I'll talk about the operating system, because I think this is one of the more interesting things that we work on at Delphix. Unlike other companies, we really do work a lot on the operating system. We've customized ZFS pretty heavily to match the use cases that we need in building this appliance. In fact, one of our features, for example, is that we allow you to provision a virtual database on a machine with a different architecture than the source. So a lot of customers like this because they have some source database on AIX, on one endianness, and they want to provision a copy of it for testing on a cheaper box, like an x86 box. And with Oracle, you have to run some very complicated scripts to convert all of the byte order in your database files. But we have developed a file system extension that swaps them transparently on demand and doesn't incur an additional storage penalty. So this is really nice. But this involved some file system changes. And in general, we have worked on a lot of file system improvements, performance improvements, new features, and things like that at Delphix. And we have done a lot of work to contribute them back to the community. So I'll talk about that layer first, the operating system layer. So before I get started, how many people have ever heard of Illumos in this room? Okay, has anyone heard of Open Solaris or Sun Solaris? Okay, a few people. So to start the story, I'll talk about Open Solaris because our operating system is ultimately descending from Open Solaris. So Open Solaris was an operating system released in 2005 as open source by Sun Microsystems. And this was released under the CDDL, which is the Common Development and Distribution License. So this is a very permissive open source license that's very similar to the Mozilla public license as well. And this operating system is basically Solaris. I mean, this is the traditional descendant of the Unix System 5 Release 4 code base that was developed in the 1980s by Sun and AT&T. So in 2005, Sun released the source code for Solaris. And by that point, there had been a lot of very interesting features that had been added, especially in the early part of 2001 through 2005. And there are a lot of nice things in Open Solaris. There's ZFS, which is a very robust file system. Has a lot of nice features for data protection and snapshotting and cloning, among many other things. It has dtrace, which is an observability tool. It's a dynamic instrumentation tool that lets you get very deep observability into the kernel and user land while the system is running. I saw there was a talk at this conference about SystemTap, which is in design a very similar tool for Linux, basically a system observability tool. And there's a lot of other features in Solaris. There's Crossbow, which is a network virtualization framework. There's Zones, which are kind of an extension of if any of you have heard of FreeBSD jails, Zones can kind of take that concept of partitions within a single instance of an operating system a little bit further. And then there's some things like the fault management architecture, which can do things like detect failures in drives proactively and take action accordingly. The service management facility, or SMF, is also there. And you can think of this kind of like next generation init.d. This is essentially the same thing as, or a similar kind of thing as Upstart or Launchd in Mac OS X, solving the same kind of problems. So anyway, Open Solaris has all of these interesting features. So what happened after 2005? So when they released Open Solaris, because of historical reasons, there were a few small components that could not be released as open source for a bunch of different reasons. And I think one of them was the NFS lock manager, for example, a very specific part of the NFS stack that Sun could not release the source for. So Illumos was a project that was designed to be a downstream repo of Open Solaris that would fill in these missing holes and add a fully open source implementation of the entire operating system. But then Sun Microsystems was acquired by Oracle Corporation. And shortly after that, Open Solaris was shut down. And in fact, the Solaris code base has continued to evolve under Oracle, but the source is no longer distributed. So at that point, the community gathered around Illumos as being the place to work on this code base in an open fashion. So Illumos is the descendant of Open Solaris, and it continues to be maintained up to the present, especially by companies like Delphix and others. And there's a community around it as well. The key takeaway with Open Solaris is that it is more than just a kernel. It is really a descendant of System 5, Release 4. So it has some user land, a really old user land. Can be surprising sometimes because you run things like date, and there are missing options that you expect that the GNU version has. So we've slowly been improving the user land tools. But it really is almost a complete system. But it's less than a distribution. I'd say that when Illumos was first created, it was intended to be, or rather when Open Solaris was created, I'm sorry, it was intended to be a complete distribution. But over time, what has been maintained and actively developed has mostly been the kernel and the core components, not so much the distribution aspects of it. So today, when you're referring to Illumos, you typically refer to Illumos, but then also a particular distribution of it, even though it's more than just a kernel. It's a little bit confusing coming from the Linux ecosystem, but ultimately, it's the same pieces. They're just sliced and diced in different ways. So that's Illumos. That's what our platform is based on. And let's talk about some of the licenses in Illumos. So Illumos has about 479 packages, if you look at what is created when you build the system. By packages here, I'm talking about IPS packages, which is the IPS is the packaging system used in Solaris and in Open Solaris and in Illumos, which is just like any other packaging system. You've probably used, you know, apt and RPM and all of these things. So there's 479 unique packages that are built when you build the Illumos gate. And there's about 400 that contain CDDL code and 251 packages that contain code from other licenses. I would say that almost every package is predominantly CDDL. And these other packages that contain other code are mostly like single files that were taken from other projects and included that are maybe BSD licensed or something like that. One of the interesting things about the CDDL is that it's a file-based license, and that files licensed under the CDDL can be combined with files licensed under other licenses, whether they're open source or proprietary. We don't really take advantage of this at Delphix to make proprietary changes, but it would be possible if someone wanted to write some proprietary code and keep it in a separate file and include that in a CDDL licensed program. That's permitted by the license. So how do we know what licenses are used when we build this operating system? Like any other packaging system, every package that is built contains a manifest. And this manifest does things like list what files are contained in the package, what permissions they have when you deploy them, all of the things that you expect a packaging system to do. And of course, it also keeps track of the licenses that are applicable to that package. So every manifest has a reference to a license file. And every time that developer integrates code that adds a new license to the product, then that developer has to update the license file in the manifest. And then when we're building our appliance, we essentially concatenate all of these license files together, and we have, you know, a list of all of the licenses that we can provide customers. So that's pretty basic. That's how we keep track of things in the operating system. And it's also important to note that this is all in its own repository. And as I mentioned, about almost every single file is CDDL licensed in some way, except for a few things that we included from other sources. So this is a very nice, discrete chunk of code that is very easy to push to GitHub. We have our own branch of it, as well as the community-maintained branch, or the sort of master repository. And every time we release software, we always post our changes to GitHub, not only to comply with the license, but to share the work that we're doing. And later on in this talk, I'll discuss some of the other work that we do to more aggressively merge things upstream and to participate in the community. So that covers the platform, the bottom two pieces. And next, I'll talk about the third-party userland software. So Illumos distributions. I mentioned earlier that Illumos is more than just a kernel, but it's not really a complete distribution, at least not nowadays. And so what does it take to make a distribution? As I'm sure most of you know, you need a couple things. You need third-party software. That's most of the work of making distribution is packaging up third-party software from different places and building it and making it easy to install. And of course, you need a package management system to do that. And this is the main difference between different Linux distributions. And also, you need some way to install the thing. Typically, people make ISOs, and you boot up some CD and install the system, or you can make a network installer. We actually have both in Illumos. But these are the three things that you need when you're building a distribution. And there are three main Illumos-based distributions nowadays. There's OpenIndiana, which is kind of the first Illumos distribution. And this was a fork from OpenSolaris directly. So this consists of everything that Sun Microsystems released back in 2005 and all the way up until the last release of the source code from Oracle before it was closed again. And as I mentioned earlier, the kernel has been really maintained, not just the kernel, but what we call the OS and networking consolidation, or the core of the system, has been really actively maintained. And that's what we call Illumos today. But OpenIndiana also forked the other parts of OpenSolaris, the packaging and the installer. Unfortunately, it has not been very well maintained up to the present, and it has a lot of really old software right now. So many businesses like ourselves are forced to switch to another distribution because we need to evolve the platform and use more recent versions of software. And so two of the more recent Illumos-based distributions are SmartOS and OmniOS. The SmartOS is a distribution developed by Joyent, which is another software company in the Bay Area. And SmartOS is focused on developing a solution for the cloud, and they've added KVM support to Illumos as part of that goal, which is very interesting work that they've done, among many other things. And OmniOS is kind of a more traditional distribution. You can install it from a CD and connect to a web-based repo and download packages and do all the things you expect. However, OmniOS is really not focused on the desktop. It is mostly focused on providing a really solid server operating system with a very well-defined set of use cases, which does not include desktop usage. And this is really to make it a small, maintainable core platform on which you can build things on top of. And our appliance is really a perfect fit for that, because we're starting with this core operating system with all the features that we care about, like ZFS and Dtrace, all these nice features, and then building our proprietary orchestration layer on top of that. So we are using OmniOS at Delphix. And OmniOS has a lot of build scripts that build the third-party software that we use. So we have something like 100 packages in the core OmniOS build system. They split up their build system into a set of core packages and a set of extra or managed services packages for their organization. So they have a variety of different repositories that you can select from. But in the core set, there's about 100 packages, and of course, third-party software is using a wide variety of licenses. There's lots of BSD, GPL v2 and v3, LGPL 2.1 and 3, a lot of MIT licensed software, a very wide variety of third-party software licenses. But again, the way that we manage these is just to use the packaging system. So we create a manifest for each package, and it contains a reference to a license file. And these build scripts themselves are all CDDL licensed, so they're licensed the same way as the rest of the operating system. But the software that they build, the result of doing the build, is a set of packages that have a wide variety of licenses. And you know, as before, we can provide visibility by concatenating these licenses together and showing that to customers, which provides visibility into what software we're using, what licenses we're using. And also we keep this, the build script for this third-party software in their own repository. So we can make changes to this and push them upstream and keep stuff on GitHub and not have to worry about separating proprietary code from the open code. So yeah, there's nothing terribly unusual about this other than maybe the fact that our base operating system is more than just the kernel. It's kind of split apart in a different way than Linux is split apart. But the same principles apply with packaging systems and manifests and licenses, license files. So the next layer up is our application libraries. As we all know, it's really hard to build any kind of application today without relying on many different libraries. Our application is, in particular, Java-based application. So we use a lot of jar files from Apache-licensed code bases. And then we have our user interface, which is in HTML and JavaScript. So there's also a lot of web front-end toolkits that are part of our application. Most of these web toolkits are LGPL or BSD or MIT. But we have a lot of different libraries that are in use. So I'll talk about how we sort of manage these. One of the most important things is that our proprietary application uses these libraries in the same address space, and therefore we can't use any GPL libraries because our application is proprietary. So that should be no shock to anyone in this room. But that's an important point, is that we can't use the GPL for any of these libraries. And we also have to provide the same visibility into what licenses we're using. And unlike the operating system that I described, we are not really integrating with any kind of package management system for our application. And moreover, it would be really hard to try to package every single library that we've ever used. Some of these are jars that have been changed over the years, and or Python modules or things like that. So we keep track of the metadata for every library that we used, and we enforce this really by convention, not by any kind of systematic build-enforced process. So every time that someone is adding a new library to our code base, we have a convention where they have to create files with a description of the library, any kind of copyright information that is relevant if it's not in the public domain, and the license for that library, and things like the version that we're using and where it was downloaded from, so we don't forget, and things like that. So the way that we enforce this is through the code review process. So we have a set of reviewers and gatekeepers that very strictly go through and review anything before it's checked in. And we have some strict rules, like every developer has to get 2 approvals from other developers before they can push a change, and one of them has to be a gatekeeper. So we have some very high quality standards for pushing code at Delphix. And part of the job of the gatekeepers in this case is to look at any new library that's being added and make sure that all of this metadata has been added in the right place and that there are no license violations that are taking place. And periodically we'll go through and update the libraries and take a second look and make sure that everything is up to date and that we're adhering to all of the licensing constraints that we have. This is probably not the best way to do things. I'm told that there's some other frameworks like Maven and Ivy that can manage your libraries for you and kind of have their own repositories for libraries like this, like JARS and Python libraries and Ruby libraries. And I'm told that things like Ivy can also keep track of all the licenses as well. So maybe eventually we'll start using one of these tools. But for now, we've just rolled our own solution, and it's just a convention-based one. And it's enforced by review. So that kind of covers the third-party software that we use. We don't really make many changes to the application libraries that we're using. So in this talk, I'm sort of focusing on how we've contributed back to the open source community. And mostly, we do that in the operating system. We aren't really involved in things like Apache Commons or anything like that. So these libraries are basically, we're consuming them, but we're not working on them or pushing anything upstream for the most part. That's about it. That's the appliance. On the very top is our data management application, and it's proprietary. And that's about it. So starting at the bottom, we have our CDDL licensed kernel and platform user land, which is kind of the descendant of OpenSolaris. Then we have third-party software of all different types that we build and deploy through a packaging system. We put our application libraries on top of that, and then our proprietary application on top of everything. Our proprietary application is in its own repository, so there's no mixing of proprietary code and other repos. And we have a pretty specific structure in place so that we can provide customers with the visibility into all of the licenses that we're using. So the lessons that we've learned. I've already mentioned all of these things. Have a structure in place for recording the metadata of licenses. It's important to do this from the very beginning. When I started at Delphix, we had been a little bit sloppy about that. So we went through and audited all of our code, made sure we found all of the licenses, and made sure that we were adhering to them and set up these conventions. It's important to make sure that developers that are adding new code are aware of the licensing implications of what they're adding. Especially in a big company, it's hard to make sure that every developer is aware of all of the complexities of the licenses that they're using, which is why we have this code review process and the gatekeepers to enforce that we're following all of the license terms. And as I mentioned, it's really important to keep the closed code separate from the open code, because when you're pushing something to GitHub, you don't want to separate out any of the closed components. So it's much simpler if you just keep the repositories separate. So those are the big lessons that we learned. Nothing terribly surprising, but I think all of these things are critical if you want to deliver high-quality software that is using all of these different licenses and to package all of that up into one appliance. So that's all I have to say about how we build our appliance. So I'll pause right here and ask if anyone has any questions, either about how we manage these different licenses or about OpenSolaris or Lumos or any of these things. Okay. So I will now talk about part two. And this part of the talk is going to be about how we collaborate on Lumos with other contributors. And this includes both corporate contributors and the community. So we're very involved in the Lumos community. And I think we have learned some really interesting lessons about how to integrate open source collaboration into our company's culture. So I'll be mostly explaining how we've done that over the years. So there are quite a few companies working on Lumos these days, as well as individual contributors. Some of the main companies are Day and Delphix, Joint, Nexenta, Omniti. And when I was creating these slides, I was curious. I took a look at the domains in the commit messages, which is really not the best metric for looking at how much a company has contributed, but it's a pretty arbitrary metric. And so this is not, you know, lines of code or anything like that, or original research or anything, but just number of commits and the domain and the email address that was used in the commit. So Sun is at the top of the list, which is not surprising at all because they created the thing and, you know, worked on it for many, many years before they released the source code. And you know, also Oracle is pretty high up because everyone's email address changed from sun.com to oracle.com after the purchase of Sun, all the way until Oracle stopped releasing source code. Also, Nexenta has been a very big developer. They create a storage appliance that is using CFS, among other things. And there are some community contributors, Richlow, for example. You see some other companies here like Joyent, who I mentioned earlier, the developers of the SmartOS distribution. Delphix is here. There's a variety of Gmail addresses for individuals. You know, OmniTI has also been pushing a lot of changes upstream lately. So there are a lot of different people working on Illumos, a lot of companies, and also a few different individuals as well. I'd say that for the most part, I think in ZFS in particular, Delphix is by far the biggest contributor. In fact, we employ one of the co-inventors of ZFS. Our CTO is one of the inventors of Dtrace. So we have a lot of the knowledge about these subsystems in-house and really have maintained and continue to innovate on the code base even after the Oracle acquisition. In fact, many of our engineers came from Oracle to Delphix, and I think you'll find a similar pattern at some of these other companies. So the bottom line, Delphix is very invested in this system, and we spend a lot of time improving it, not only for our own needs in our appliance, but to make the system better for everyone. So how do we do Illumos development at Delphix? I mentioned earlier that at Delphix, engineers are really working on the whole stack. So you know, we try to avoid a notion of an engineer that only works on one specific thing and never goes outside of that. You know, I developed a feature that involved making changes in the GUI, making changes in the Java orchestration layer, making changes at the file system level. So we really try to push our engineers to work on the whole stack and to really take one feature and develop it from start to finish. We find that this really makes for very good products when you have this kind of culture. So everyone at Delphix works on the OS, or not everyone, but many people. And you know, people also work on the Java application. And as I mentioned, we have our own branch of Illumos. It's on GitHub. I also should have put the link to the main Illumos gate, but it's easy to find. I'll discuss our process in this talk because I think it's interesting how we manage our own branch and pushing changes upstream and collaborating with other companies. Essentially, all of these companies that I mentioned here have their own branch, and all of them are pushing upstream to a central repository. But also, we are all working on our own features internally, and only gradually pushing them upstream. And why do we push things upstream at all? Well, you know, we want to improve Illumos because we care. We want the system to be maintainable, and we are committed to using it in the long term. So that's obviously an important reason. At Dulfix, we really try to proactively push as much as possible from our branch back upstream. And we do this pretty aggressively. And another reason is just to avoid merge conflicts. You know, when you have four different companies all working on the same code base with their own branches pretty aggressively, and you want to take a change from another company and apply it onto your branch, then if you haven't merged with master in a long time, then you're going to have many, many conflicts, and it's going to be difficult to resolve them. So by pushing things upstream as soon as possible, we essentially transfer that problem to someone else. So that helps a lot. So how do we decide what to push upstream? So we have our branch, and we're constantly adding new features to it. I mentioned, for example, the byte order swapping feature that we've developed that lets us provision virtual databases to other architectures. We've done a wide variety of improvements, especially to ZFS. We've been doing a lot of performance work. So what we do is run git diff against upstream. Upstream is Aluma's gate. And we do this in a couple of different subdirectories, directories where we are making a lot of changes. So you know, we'll go into the ZFS directory, run a diff against upstream, and then look at each line that changed and run git blame against that line. So this will show the commit that introduced this change. And then we group all of these commits and sort them by the order in which we committed them to our branch. So we always try to integrate our changes upstream in the same order that we were integrating them into our own branch. And that's really for simplicity. Because if we try to apply a change upstream in a different order, then this is also going to create a lot of merge conflicts, and it will take a long time to address them all. So that's sort of how we decide what to push upstream. This, of course, means that it's much easier to push things upstream if your commits on your branch are very isolated. So you don't want to commit something to your branch that has five features in one commit, because then you have to either push the whole thing upstream or then break it apart into the individual changes. And this is also takes some time. So it's easier, as we've learned, just to keep the commits on our branch as specific as possible, you know, fixing one bug or adding one feature per commit. And then we just push those upstream in the same order. What do we not push upstream? A common pattern that we've seen is that people will commit things internally that are good enough for the use case we have at Dulfix, but not necessarily complete for general purpose usage. So one example of that might be ZFS supports something called RAID-Z, which is an alternative to RAID that is based at the storage pool level in ZFS. I won't discuss it too much, but the point is that we don't use RAID-Z in our appliance. It's part of Illumos, it's part of ZFS, but we just don't use it in our particular case. So sometimes people might make a change that could theoretically affect RAID-Z. We don't have time to test it or to make sure that it is valid. But we'll still push it anyway, because we know that we're never going to use RAID-Z, so it's okay if we break it by accident. I don't think that we've actually done anything like that, but I'm using this as a theoretical example. Another case might be some customer found a bug, and they're screaming at us to fix it right away, and we're doing as much as we can to fix the bug as soon as possible, and we don't have time to go through and make the complete fix right away. So these things we don't push upstream. But usually, one of these changes will be caught by this script that I mentioned, this diffing script. And then the person that discovers it will often go find the original author and say, hey, I know that this is good enough, but we should really finish this and do whatever it takes to make it complete so that we can go push it upstream. And usually you can prod people a little bit, and they'll go ahead and finish the work, and then we can push things upstream after that. So the way things work is, how do we push things upstream to Illumos? I think the process is a bit different than in other open source operating systems. I'm not intimately familiar with the process in Linux or in BSD, but the way that it works in Illumos is that you post to a mailing list, the Illumos developer list, and you get code reviews. And you go through and address the feedback. And once you've resolved all of the issues, you send a push request to another email list called the advocates list. And these advocates essentially, you know, put the rubber stamp and say, they make sure that the right people have reviewed the code. So if you're changing ZFS and haven't had someone who's knowledgeable about ZFS review the code, they'll tell you to go have that person review it. They make sure that you've addressed all of the comments that people have raised and that you've tested your change sufficiently, and then you can push after that, or rather they do the push. And the goal with the Illumos gate is always to keep the quality very high. We have this term we use, FCS, or first customer ship, which really originates from Sun. But the goal of the Illumos gate is to always be ready to ship at any time. You can never be like building an experimental feature and break the gate for a couple days while you're working on something. No, you push complete features, they're reviewed very thoroughly, and the gate is always stable all the time. So this is our goal with Illumos. So I know that in other systems, people have like commit privileges, and they get some bit that says that they can commit, and they don't really have to go through much review. But in Illumos, even an advocate can't push without having another advocate approve it. So you know, even an advocate has to go through this process. And the onus is really on the person making the change to make sure that people review it, that the advocates look at it. And you really have to push things through all of this process to get them integrated. So it's a very high bar for quality. Lessons learned. As I mentioned, in the early days, we were often committing a lot of things in one commit. That doesn't make sense. We're often putting together a lot of changes in one commit. And then when we wanted to push them upstream, it was hard to split them apart. So these days, we have tried to be more careful about keeping every single commit isolated to a specific bug fix or a specific feature. And also in the early days, we often would make changes to our branch and not really think too much about how hard it would be to upstream them. And that has changed a lot. We have a really strict policy now that every single change to our branch should be ready to push upstream unless there is a very specific reason, like a customer is complaining, like there's a fire that we need to put out immediately. But beside those exceptions, we really try very hard to make every single commit to our branch fully complete and ready to push upstream. Even to the point where our internal review process has become so thorough that when we post requests externally on the developer list, oftentimes there's no feedback because we have reviewed the code so much internally that it's done and it's ready to push upstream. So beyond pushing code, we've done some other things as well. We're very involved in the Illumos community. We've mentored some community contributors who want to work on a new feature in ZFS, and we'll put them in touch with one of our developers and give them some guidance about how to implement things and go through code review with them. We've done a lot of stuff with our build and continuous integration and QA infrastructure. So it's running against both our own branch and the central Illumos gate. In fact, we developed most of the ZFS QA infrastructure in-house and then pushed it to Illumos. So we're always trying to make sure that Illumos gate is stable, that we're testing changes and ensuring that we contribute our testing infrastructure back to the community. And we've done some things like ZFS Day, which was a conference for ZFS development. So we got a lot of different ZFS contributors from different organizations in the community and had a conference about ZFS. And the last thing we're doing is something called OpenZFS, which is still hasn't launched yet. And this is the last slide I have. But essentially, there is a lot of effort going on to work on ZFS in different communities these days. ZFS is officially part of FreeBSD. It's part of the main source code for FreeBSD. It's obviously part of Illumos because that's where it originated. There is a version of ZFS for Mac OS X. It's not part of the official Mac OS X release, but there is a port that works pretty well. And there's also a Linux port, which is not part of Linux officially, but it works very well. And all of these groups are finding bugs and fixing them and working on ZFS. So we're trying to coordinate all of this development across all these different platforms and really concentrate on the core of ZFS. And sort of this is in contrast to the Oracle version of ZFS, which is now closed source. So we're launching this effort in mid-September. And if you'll allow me to do some shameless plugs, if you're interested in learning more about Illumos or ZFS or any of this open source operating system work that we're doing, there's a wiki, there's mailing lists, and like I mentioned, later in September, there's going to be a new website for OpenZFS, and you'll get to see how to develop ZFS and how to install it on Linux or Mac OS or FreeBSD and try to create more of a community around this open file system. So that's the second part. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Yes?
It's already part of the FreeBSD, how can it be launched later?
So the question is, if ZFS is already part of FreeBSD, how can it be launched later? And I would like to clarify that when I said that OpenZFS will be launched, I'm referring to the launch of the community portal and the community website, not the integration of the code. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much. And I also have t-shirts, so if you want a free t-shirt, I'll be happy to give you one. And thanks for coming.